The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles principally from the Harvard Heart Letter. And this is the Harvard Heart Letter of May 2024. And the first article is entitled, Practical Pointers About Protein. For optimal heart health, pay more attention to the quality of your protein sources rather than the quantity. Popular diets often encourage people to cut back on carbs or eat less fat. When it comes to protein, however, advice about the ideal daily amount has been mixed. Does the average American eat too much protein or not enough? People who take weight loss drugs and people with kidney disease, many of whom also have cardiovascular disease, may need to track their protein intake more closely. But in general, it's more important to focus on the source of your protein than worry about the quantity. Almost all generally healthy diets will easily provide adequate amounts of protein, says Dr. Walter Willett, professor of epidemiology and nutrition at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. That's even true for people who follow a plant-only vegan diet, provided they eat several servings of nuts, beans, or soy-based foods every day. Even if you include animal-based protein sources like meat, fish, eggs, and dairy products in your diet, as most Americans do, it's increasingly clear that an eating pattern that features plenty of plant-based protein is superior for cardiovascular health. That's because beans, nuts, and seeds are high in fiber, unsaturated fat, and other nutrients closely linked to a lower risk of heart disease. To keep your heart healthy, experts recommend limiting protein sources that are high in saturated fat, which raise harmful LDL cholesterol. Chicken and turkey are healthier choices. But fatty fish like salmon and tuna, which contain heart-protecting omega-3 fats, are an even better option. Eating an egg a day doesn't seem to affect heart disease risk. That's also the case for full-fat dairy products like milk, yogurt, and cheese, although Dr. Willett suggests limiting yourself to one or two servings a day. There's no firm consensus on the optimal amount of protein a person should eat each day, and it varies depending on your age, your sex, and activity level. For the average adult, the recommended dietary allowance, the amount you need to meet your basic nutritional requirements and avoid illness, is 0.8 grams per kilogram of body weight. According to this formula, you should multiply your weight in pounds by 0.36 to estimate the grams of protein you should eat daily. This USDA calculator uses that formula and also takes into account your age, sex, and activity level. And there's a calculator at www.health.harvard.edu/HNFSCALC. But this formula is based on older studies of protein requirements, says Dr. Willett. And as such, it doesn't account for the fact that in the United States, the average body weight and fat mass have increased a great deal over the last 50 years. For gauging your protein intake, it may be reasonable to use your ideal body weight instead. As an example, the average American woman is close to 5 feet 4 inches tall and weighs 170 pounds. If she's 65 years old and active, the calculator suggests 62 grams of protein daily. But if you instead use your ideal weight of 120 pounds, the estimate is far lower, just 44 grams. If you're overweight, which includes the majority of American adults, basing your protein requirement on your weight may give an estimate that's too high, says dietitian Mark O'Meara, an outpatient senior nutrition counselor at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. Consuming too much protein adds unneeded calories and contributes to weight gain, he says. On the other hand, people who are taking the new weight loss drug semaglutide, which is also called Wegovy, and tirzepatide, which is called Zepbound, may actually eat too little protein. Some of my clients who take these medications feel so full and satisfied from just small amounts of food, they barely eat, says Dr. O'Meara. They're losing lots of fat, but also some muscle mass, especially if they skimp on protein. This also may be an issue for certain older people, especially women, who don't eat enough protein due to a waning appetite. People with moderate to severe kidney disease also need to pay attention to their protein intake because eating too much may impair kidney function. If you fall into any of these groups, work with a dietitian to ensure you're eating an appropriate amount of protein, O'Meara advises. O'Meara's advice, which makes sense for everyone, is to include some protein in every single meal and snack. Aim for roughly equal amounts of protein and carbohydrate. Maybe a half an apple and a handful of mixed nuts, crackers and cheese, or hummus and carrots. Wondering how to get more plant-based protein in your diet? Baked tofu, which is firmer and more flavorful than plain tofu, and tempeh, a fermented soy product, are easy to add to salads or stir fries in place of meat, says O'Meara. Try different veggie burgers to find one you like. He also recommends trying nutritional yeast, which has a nutty, somewhat cheesy flavor in place of Parmesan cheese. Now in the Harvard Heart Letter of May 2024, we're going to turn to a section called Ask the Doctor. This is with Dr. Christopher Cannon, who's the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Heart Letter. And the question is, I have a thoracic aortic aneurysm that was discovered 5 years ago. I've been getting yearly scans to monitor the size, and so far it seems to be growing very slowly. But if it reaches a certain size, my cardiologist says I might need surgery. Are there any less invasive options to fix this problem? And Dr. Cannon responds, yes, some aortic aneurysms can be repaired with a non-surgical procedure known as endovascular repair. However, the most appropriate treatment for an aortic aneurysm depends on not only the size, but also the location of the aneurysm, as well as your age, overall health, and whether you've had any previous heart surgeries. An aortic aneurysm is a weakened area in the wall of the aorta, the main pipeline for blood from the heart to the body. The section that curves out from the heart, the thoracic aorta, ends at the diaphragm, which separates the chest from the abdomen. Thoracic aneurysms can occur in the section closest to the heart, called the ascending aorta, or the straight section after the curved arch, the descending aorta. Most occur in people with risk factors like high blood pressure and high cholesterol. But some ascending aortic aneurysms occur in young people with connective tissue disorders or a bicuspid aortic valve in which the valve has two flaps instead of three. Thoracic aortic aneurysms that stay small and stable are relatively harmless, but those that grow too large may bulge outward and rupture, which can lead to catastrophic bleeding. The size threshold for recommending a repair varies depending on the person. Aneurysms in the descending aorta can sometimes be repaired with an endovascular stent graft, a tube made from special fabric. For this procedure, the doctor inserts the folded graft through a tiny cut in the blood vessel at the top of the thigh and threads it up the aorta to the bulging section. There he unfolds it. According to my colleague Dr. Eric Isselbacher, co-director of the Thoracic Aortic Center at Massachusetts General Hospital, This approach is much more technically challenging for aneurysms in the ascending aorta. As he explains, the graft needs to be snugly attached to the wall of the aorta, where it arises from the heart, but this is where blood flow is most forceful. There are also other anatomic challenges, including the curve of the aorta and the coronary arteries that branch out from it. In the future, endovascular techniques may evolve to address those challenges. But for now, aneurysms in the ascending aorta need to be repaired with open heart surgery, in which the surgeon replaces the bulging part of the aorta with a graft and sews it in place. Now here's a useful article entitled Advice for Aging Exercise Enthusiasts. Are you one of those people who not only meets but routinely exceeds the recommended amount of exercise on most days? The federal guidelines called for 150 minutes of moderate intensity exercise or 75 minutes of vigorous intensity exercise every week for all adults, including those age 65 and older. But some people spend far more time exercising, clocking daily hour-long runs or gym workouts, often coupled with lots of physical activity on the weekends, playing tennis, cycling, hiking, or skiing. In general, exercise-related injuries to the joints, tendons, and muscles become more common with age, mostly due to natural declines in muscle mass and flexibility. The prevalence of heart disease also rises with age. How does exercise, especially higher than average amounts, affect that risk? Without question, exercise is the best medicine for your heart. Physical activity profoundly improves your cardiovascular health and longevity, says Dr. Megan Wofsy, a cardiologist at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. And she notes there are people who, by virtue of a combination of good lifestyle habits and good genes, can continue to exercise at high levels well into their 60s and beyond. Still, don't assume that the more exercise you do, the better, says Dr. Wofsy. The most impressive benefits occur when a person who has been inactive starts doing regular moderate intensity exercise. Doing more offers some added benefits, but only up to a point. One study tracked exercise and longevity in more than 660,000 people, with a follow-up that lasted an average of 14 years. Researchers found that even people who did less than the minimum amount of exercise recommended by the guidelines had a 20% lower risk of dying compared with inactive people. Those who did double the minimum amount lowered their risk by 31%, and those who did 3 to 5 times the minimum had a 39% lower risk. Beyond that, more exercise didn't earn any additional survival benefit. However, there was no evidence of any downside, even at levels 10 times more than the minimum. So if you're accustomed to doing lots of exercise, staying the course as you age seems to be safe. As a person who is highly active myself, I recognize that there are other reasons for exercising beyond improving heart health, says Dr. Wofsy. Exercise helps people maintain a healthy weight and also helps to tame stress, especially when you work out with other people. But it's fine if you decide to dial back your routine to a more moderate level. A less intensive regimen may protect you from overuse injuries, but still benefits your cardiovascular health. Still, just because people are physically active doesn't mean they are immune to heart problems. Here's Dr. Wofsy's advice. First, get routine checkups and keep tabs on your heart-related risk factors. I sometimes worry that doctors may be biased to undertreat risk factors like high blood pressure or high cholesterol in people who appear very fit and healthy, says Dr. Wofsy. Another issue she's encountered: avid exercisers are often reluctant to take medications because they feel they can control their risk with lifestyle changes alone. But you can't outrun dangerously elevated levels of LDL cholesterol, which should be treated with medication. Don't assume you can eat whatever you want. People who exercise a great deal can certainly consume more than their sedentary counterparts because their workouts burn so many calories. That doesn't mean you can ignore the standard advice for a heart-healthy diet. You still need to limit foods that promote narrowing of the heart's arteries, says Dr. Wofsy. Too much saturated fat and highly processed carbohydrates like crackers, chips, and cookies, and sugary treats in your diet can crowd out more healthful foods like fruits, vegetables, and whole grains. In general, highly active people tend to be good patients in this regard as far as paying attention to heart-related symptoms because they're tuned into their bodies, says Dr. Wofsy. When people are used to running at a certain pace, they notice if they are suddenly getting slower than normal. If there's no reasonable explanation, for example, they took time off or are recovering from an injury, that may be a reason to check in with a doctor, she says. Sometimes the first symptom of atherosclerosis or a heart rhythm disturbance can be a subtle reduction in exercise capacity, Dr. Wofsy says. Now here's an interesting article again from the Harvard Heart Letter of May 2024, and it's entitled Sleep and Brain Health, What's the Connection? Disrupted sleep, which has many causes, is linked to a heightened risk of stroke, including silent ones. A sleep shortfall doesn't just make you feel groggy and grumpy the next day. Over time, insufficient sleep can harm your cardiovascular health. The evidence is so compelling, the American Heart Association added healthy sleep duration to its Life Essential 8 recommendations to lower heart attack and stroke risk. And these recommendations are at www.health.harvard.edu/ESSENTIAL8. Adults should strive for 7 to 9 hours of sleep every night, but the quality of your sleep is also important, says Dr. Susan Redline, the Peter C. Farrell Professor of Sleep Medicine at Harvard Medical School. Various sleep problems can cause disrupted or fragmented sleep. Even if you sleep for at least 7 hours, sleep disruptions can prevent you from getting enough deep sleep and may also cause unhealthy blood pressure surges, says Dr. Redline. These problems may increase the risk of cerebral vascular disease and cognitive issues, according to a scientific statement by the AHA published in the March 2024 issue of the journal Stroke. Cerebral vascular disease includes conditions that affect the brain's blood vessels, including silent strokes, which go unrecognized. Over the course of the night, people cycle through different phases of sleep, spending about a quarter of the time in deep, slow-wave sleep, a phase that's vital to restoring energy and supporting memory, says Dr. Redline, who co-authored the AHA statement. Blood pressure and heart rate are at their lowest point during deep sleep. Meanwhile, the brain's housekeeping system, a series of channels called the G lymphatic system, which drains cerebrospinal fluid, flushes away toxins, including beta amyloid and other proteins linked to Alzheimer's disease. When people who don't get sufficient amounts of deep sleep, blood pressure may not decline as it should. This can trigger activity in cells and blood vessel walls and activate damaging inflammation. The G lymphatic system, which functions depends on healthy brain blood vessels, may falter. Brief awakenings during the night, especially those caused by sleep apnea, can cause surges in the hormone epinephrine and raise blood pressure, a problem known as nocturnal hypertension. These blood pressure elevations can leave people at risk for cerebrovascular problems, says Dr. Redline. Small blood vessels deep in the brain may be damaged by tiny clots or microbleeds, causing so-called silent strokes, which cause no noticeable symptoms. But a series of such strokes over time can lead to a condition called multi-infarct dementia. If you don't feel rested and refreshed when you wake up in the morning, despite getting at least 7 hours of sleep, you might have a sleep disorder. Talk to your doctor for help identifying and addressing the problem. If your bed partner or family member says you snore loudly, see, quote, "Should you be tested for sleep apnea?" end quote, in the May 2023 Heart Letter. Even if you don't think you have insomnia, you might be experiencing frequent brief awakenings without noticing them. Wearable devices, monitors worn on the wrist or finger, feature apps that measure sleep efficiency. The data may provide clues about brief awakenings as well as limb movements during sleep, says Dr. Redline. Make an effort to follow all the steps in life's essential eight, which are closely interrelated. Think of sleep as one of the vital habits that helps to reinforce all the other healthy practices, says Dr. Redline. Now here's another article from the Harvard Heart Letter, and it's entitled "The Lowdown on a Low Heart Rate." Known as bradycardia, this heart rhythm disorder can cause fatigue, dizziness, and fainting. The steady beat of your heart depends on a tiny cluster of cells located in the upper right chamber of your heart. Called the sinoatrial node or sinus node, these cells generate a tiny jolt of electricity that triggers the heart to contract and pump blood throughout the body. Because the sinus node sets the heart pace and rhythm, it's often referred to as the body's natural pacemaker. But several backup generators elsewhere in the heart can keep this vital system functioning. A normal heart rate is from 60 to 100 beats per minute, although it may drop as low as 40 during deep sleep. A heart rate below 60 beats per minute during the day is considered a low heart rate, or what doctors call bradycardia. If your heart rate is low and you don't have any symptoms, there's no reason to worry. But if you do have symptoms like feeling dizzy, lightheaded, fatigued, breathless, or confused, or if you faint, seek medical care right away. Here's the lowdown on possible causes. What causes a low heart rate? The most common cause of bradycardia is age-related degenerative changes in the heart's conducting system, says Dr. Matthew Yuyun, a cardiologist at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. Just as your skin, joints, and other parts of your body reveal signs of wear and tear as you age, so too can the structures inside your heart. It's why bradycardia that requires treatment is more common in older adults, usually after age 70. Other heart-related issues can leave people more prone to bradycardia. They include a previous heart attack, heart failure, a heart procedure, or heart inflammation caused by infections, says Dr. Yuyun. One example is Lyme disease, a tick-borne infection common in New England that, if left untreated, can infiltrate heart tissue and interfere with electrical signals. Other problems include repeated breathing pauses during sleep called obstructive sleep apnea, an imbalance of minerals in the blood, like potassium or calcium, certain medications like blood pressure drugs, especially beta blockers, sedatives, and opioids, and also diseases like lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, sarcoidosis, and hemochromatosis. However, in athletes and very physically active people, a low heart rate, even down to 45 beats per minute, is perfectly normal. Regular exercise makes the heart stronger and more efficient. Because each heartbeat delivers more blood to the body, the heart doesn't need to beat as quickly, he adds. Because episodes of bradycardia may come and go, a brief measurement of the heart's electrical activity may not pick up the problem. Instead, people often need to wear a portable heart monitor that records the heart's rate and rhythm for at least a day, and sometimes several weeks. Treatment depends on the cause and severity. Addressing the underlying condition or adjusting medications sometimes helps. In other cases, people need a pacemaker, a small battery-powered device that sends pulses of electricity through wires in your heart. Irreversible damage to the heart's electrical system requires a permanent pacemaker. These devices, which are placed during a minor surgical procedure, are programmed to stimulate your heart as needed to keep it beating normally. Most are implanted under the skin in the upper chest, but some people receive a tiny wireless device the size of a vitamin pill that is inserted in the right side of the heart. And there's a brief section about the heart's electrical conduction system, which says that the sinoatrial node emits tiny electrical impulses that signal the atria to constrict, filling the ventricles with blood. The atrial ventricular node, located between the right atrium and ventricle, conducts the electric signal from the atria to the ventricle. The ventricles then contract, pumping blood into the circulation. A low heart rate can occur if the SA node falters. When that happens, the AV node takes over and maintains a heart rate of about 50 to 60. If the electrical signals passing through this area are slowed or blocked, it's called AV block or heart block. Next in the conduction pathways are the left and right bundle branches, which are the final signals telling the ventricles to contract. If all those backups fail, the heart muscle may still contract, but only about 20 to 40 beats per minute, too slow to provide enough blood to the brain. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.